to the Latino Vote Podcast. We come to you today with a special guest, Aaron Zitner from the Wall Street Journal. And we also have, of course, our fearless leaders, Mike Madrid and Chuck Rocha, who is sporting a very interesting hat today. Tell me a little bit about that hat, Chuck.
This is my Lake Palestine fishing hat. Jason knows where Lake Palestine is in Deep East Texas. And if you ride around fishing a lot and you don't have no hair, you need to have a good hat collection. And so throughout this podcast, I'm going to be highlighting different hats in my hat collection. Today is fishing hat day.
Well, we missed the red jacket with your logo on the back. And I don't see the Madrid tuxedo today either. He does have it on. It's just not... Oh, that's nice.
It's every day. It's every day where I go formal, Madrid formal every day.
Well, Aaron, you also look quite dapper in the black pullover in the white shirt. We often compare fashion as we begin our discussions each day. But thank you.
I was supposed to dress up. So.
Thank you for being here. We are honored with your presence, and you're actually the Latino Vote Podcast's very first guest. As you might know, we're newer to this project, and we want to bring people on that have insight and have exhibited just real understanding of the Latino vote and Latino issues in general across the country. I took a specific interest in your work just because we've talked about some of the Texas issues that are occurring, and some of your pieces, I think, are really interesting, particularly some polls that you've had relating to the shift and some of the voting patterns of Hispanics around the country. So with that, let's start off with your most recent piece and tell us a little bit about that, that relating to the Hispanic shift, and then also other information relating to that around other pieces that I know you've written recently.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for calling me a special guest, as well as just a guest. the data, you guys are practitioners, so you know that the data that we use to guide our opinions of politics can be dicey and flawed and contradictory, but I do take as good assessment as any, the work by Catalyst, which is the Democratic kind of supplier of voter data to Democratic and progressive groups. I take their assessment that Biden underperformed Hillary Clinton by about 8 percentage points in his share of the Hispanic vote. The share voting Democratic fell by about 8 points, according to them, between 16 and 20. And that this is pervasive, that, you know, we all in the media rushed to the Rio Grande Valley and South Florida after the election to where you saw a pretty prominent shift, and where two congressional seats in South Florida flipped to the Republican Party. And that was thought to be fueled by a shift in the Latino vote. But Catalyst and others make a convincing case that this is nationwide. It's in Philadelphia. You can see the vote there. It's in New York City. The more Hispanic a borough is, the more likely Trump was to have improved on his 2016 showing. And I went to the city of Reading, Pennsylvania, and I went there for a couple reasons. One, when we talk about the vote shift, we really need to look at a very Hispanic place. If you're going to a place that's, say, 50-50, Latino, non-Latino, and you see a vote shift, you don't know, was it the Latino vote that shifted or some other group? And Reading is the most Latino municipality in Pennsylvania, about 70% Hispanic, and it's got an interesting, the place tells a story, you know? It's a industrial town, railroad town, and it just incredibly became more and more Hispanic. Mushroom farms, there's mushroom farming, brought people in. And I think just its location on several major interstates, not too far from New York and Philadelphia, brought people who wanted to get out of those big cities. And they came into Reading. And when I went in 2016, I met with a group of Republicans put together by the Republican Party. And what you sensed in that group was a racial grievance, white flight. They said to me, we are hungry for America to be made great again. And I think what they were saying is, we've lost our city. So it was quite interesting to go there a few months ago, knowing that there had been this vote shift toward Hispanic voters, and talk to Hispanic voters and ask about this vote shift in the shadow of what had been what I thought a white vote shift earlier. And I'll tell you the three major things I found. One, I found a very strong sense of Latino identity, which is important to Anglos like me, because one thing I often hear people say is, oh, Hispanic voters are just becoming like white voters. They have the same aspirations. And so they're voting like white voters. They're not any different. And I found a very distinct Latino identity, not only when I talk to people, but just drive around. You see Puerto Rican flags flying next to American flags and Dominican flags flying next to American flags. And the supermarket has all the flags of Central and South America painted on the exterior, and a real sense among people of the growing economic power of the Latino voter and a desire for there to be political power with that. Reading just recently elected its first Hispanic mayor a few years ago, a Democrat. And that same year, that county elected its first Hispanic county commissioner, a Republican. And I see a point of pride in that. So one was strong Latino identity commensurate with economic identity. Second was political fluidity. I met a guy who had been on the Reading City Council as a Democrat, changed parties to campaign and support the Republican Hispanic gentleman who was running for county commissioner, and then switched back to support Joe Biden and work for him in his presidential race. And I heard other stories like that about people who had been Democrats switching to Republicans, and in some cases switching back. And that is important. And it's something you see in some of the work by practitioners like Eckes, which is there is a new permission structure that I believe Eckes found and which I saw in Reading, a permission structure that's changed. It used to be, I'd heard people say, oh, if I considered voting Republican, my family would be really angry at me. Or you come from Puerto Rico, you register, you're going to vote Democratic. I think that has changed. And Hispanic voters, at least that I took to talk to, were more open to the Republican Party and had the permission to do so. The third thing I found was a disillusionment with both political parties over immigration, which remained an important issue to the people I talked to. I pressed people. I said, you're angry at both parties, but one party is working to legalize Dreamers. One party supports a pathway to citizenship. Don't they get any credit? And I heard not so much. And I heard stories like the gentleman who was coming back from his honeymoon during the Obama years, and he and his wife, new wife, were stopped at the border, and she was deported back to her home country in Central America. And it took him 4 years and the help of a Republican congressman to get her into the country, and real anger at the deportations and immigration policy, not just under Trump, but under Obama. So those were the main things I found. And to me, they helped explain what might be going on in the minds of voters, Hispanic voters, as they make voting decisions.
I want to bring Chuck and Mike in on this conversation. Chuck, first, I'm not certain if you have a candidate in that region, but I know you know that part of the country well. What is your sense of that? And is there a change? And is it driven by the Puerto Rican community in that area? Just talk to me about what your thoughts are on that region. You're on mute.
So Aaron brings up some great points, and a couple of them. First is, yes, I know the Reading, Allentown, Bethlehem, Scranton areas of Pennsylvania very well. Once in my life, I was the national political director, Aaron, of the United Steelworkers, and I started in a rubber worker factory in East Texas. And so in the late 90s, I was sent by President George Becker of the Steelworkers to move to Allentown and Bethlehem to run a steelworker for Congress, Mike, in the old 15th Congressional District of Pennsylvania, where a young, strapping Republican newcomer that was going to run for Congress in an open Democratic seat by the name of Pat Toomey. And so I ran the first race against him with the steelworker district director out there, Ed O'Brien, from the O'Brien family, from the steel mill there in Bethlehem. Now, that whole area has just transformed into a different kind of place with the steel mill shutting. And what you saw there, and one of the first things I remember about Bethlehem, or Bethlehem, as they say, is across the river, there was this whole emerging, this is in 2000, Puerto Rican community that blew this Texas-Mexican away. So this is just built off of A, people avoiding high taxes in New York, coming to Pennsylvania, same thing in New Jersey. You had the hurricane and had another couple hundred thousand come because they could live with family members who had then been there for 20 years and had set up, you know, an infrastructure. But instead of going into all the details, because I could talk about Eastern Pennsylvania forever and this Latino growth, and there's a bunch of Latino nonprofits doing work there. And Aaron, you should know, in full disclosure, I work with Equis, I work with Catalyst, I work with Michael Frias, Stephanie Valencia, and some of the best people doing some of this work. And so what Aaron described, though, if we stood back, and I don't want to Mike Madrid this wind up, but if I took a step back and told you what I think that's the most important thing that Aaron is saying, is he's describing probably 20 different areas of America right now that we don't talk about. Mm. We don't talk about these immigrant communities in Kansas, in North Carolina, in the southern part of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, outside of places that you historically don't talk about, because to Aaron's point, we all talked about the 20-point bump in Miami-Dade and in the Texas Valley. But all across America, all depending on whether you had a presidential ticket at the top pumping in money, somewhat in Spanish or not, you saw this underperformance. But these new, what I call emerging Latino communities, are going to be the bedrock of what we talked about in the last episode of why there's so many congressional districts now that have a heavier Latino population that are marginal, because these are the districts keeping up with that growth in sporadic areas that are these emerging communities that people really aren't watching right now. And they're creating their own infrastructure. They're creating their own dialogue amongst each other. Some of them not knowing if they're Democrat or Republican, figuring out who's going to talk to them, figuring out local politics, which I find to be the most fascinating.
Mike, you're our resident expert on the differences among Latinos in different parts of the country. California, different than the Cubanos in Florida, different than the Tejanos in Texas. We don't talk much about the Puerto Rican community. How do they relate and how do they fit into the matrix that we're talking about right now? And do they have a different perspective or different understanding or issues that drive them versus what you wrote about so eloquently in the New York Times recently?
Well, the short answer is yeah, of course they do, because first of all, they're American citizens and the politicization process is very, very different. Although you could probably equate some of people leaving actually the island of Puerto Rico to the immigrant experience that they find here. A lot of people have a background not only in voting in elections, and of course they're not allowed to vote in all elections as a territory of the United States and not a state, but they're, you know, Puerto Ricans are obviously American citizens and have been civically engaged in a very unique way amongst the Hispanic population in the country. It's also not uncommon to see Republican office holders on the island of Puerto Rico and an active Republican Party in Puerto Rico. And that's a little bit different than most other Hispanic groups, with the obvious exception of Cuban Americans. And I do want to say, Aaron, I thought it was a fantastic piece, just this latest piece that you had. It's great to see that type of narrative being driven for a few reasons. The first, I do want to point out, you know, a little bit more texture, nuance, and see kind of if you agree. There is one point as a practitioner where I do probably have a little bit of a point of contention, which is using Hispanic density as a marker for what is happening in the community. There's no question we have had to and need to do better in understanding more Hispanic dense precincts if we're going to get a more accurate assessment of the community. But there's also a lot of truth to the fact that second and third generation Hispanics tend to live in less Hispanic dense precincts. And because of the changes of where they are moving, we are able to use regression analysis to identify some of those changes. And even if we can't get it 100%, we can get it pretty darn close to demonstrate that actually a lot of that shift is happening in more in later generations, as Latinos and Hispanics are moving further and further away from the immigrant experience, we are seeing a lot of that trend line of previous immigrant groups in the past. And I still do equate a lot of that experience as very, very similar to what we saw and see with Italians and Poles and Greeks at the turn of the last century, where there was this strong ethnic identity, which does dissipate, obviously, over the generation, but it remains there for a couple or three generations and sometimes a little bit longer, even though voting patterns tend to look like the overall mainstream or whatever the right vernacular is, dominant or mainstream society. The second is, and this has been a real, real fascinating area for me to look at, is we keep talking about the rightward shift, which is happening in Hispanic dense communities. It is happening in immigrant precincts. It's also happening, as I just mentioned, in later generation. There's just kind of a broad-based deep shift happening all over the country, with one very big notable exception, two actually. And they are exceptions because they are the dominant place where Hispanics are at, which is California. There has not been you may see some marginal movement on the corners in both directions, incidentally, but this shift has not happened in California, and it's not happening in Arizona. And it's really important because there's a unique politicization process that has happened there. And I think as we're watching, and I say we, all of us here on the podcast, but we, all of us in the country, as we're watching this shift happen, it's extremely important to note that it is happening in all of these places where there are newer, more discernible Hispanic communities. No offense to Puerto Ricans who've been in this grouping for a long time, and also Cubans, of course, and Central Americans. But when you have 60% of the Hispanic population being Mexican American in the country, and when you have the majority of those living in California and in Arizona, Texas, of course, is probably the anomaly here, not experiencing the shift, in fact, growing in the other direction. To me, it's fascinating because a lot of the data, even when we're able to finally get it accurate in national polling, it doesn't speak to the tremendous, tremendous shift that is happening outside of California and Arizona. And I don't want to get too in the weeds to lose too many people, but the bottom line is, if you set California and Arizona aside, which the Democratic Party believed that was going to be the future of the country, and you took that out of our national pollings of Hispanics, you see that the shift is even more dramatic than these 2, 3, 4, 5, 8 point shifts. They're actually quite more sizable than even that. So it's a fascinating discussion just to watch this get richer and richer with more and more nuance and understanding. And it also speaks to the impact that these voters are going to have in places like Pennsylvania, in places like North Carolina, in places where Wisconsin, Georgia, places that we did not 5, 6, 8 years ago notice as discernible a part of the electorate, becoming increasingly more impactful. So fascinating research, Aaron. Just looking forward to more of your work, and a big fan of what you're doing, and watching this unfold is going to be just amazing.
Speaking of your work, Aaron, I know that you and I talked about your role at the Wall Street Journal of being essentially the engineer for polling, and how you're the clearinghouse of the polls and some of the things that you're looking at. You know, one of the pieces that you wrote, I want to say late last year, really received quite a bit of attention, and it drove the narrative, I think, going into the new year. And that was about how Hispanics, just nationwide now, are almost are Republicans are equal in generic Republican, generic Democrat testing. And so Republicans have historically not done as well as Democrats, but your research showed that it was getting even. And tell us about your role at the Wall Street Journal as sort of the person on point for polling, and then also a little bit about that poll and what it told you.
Yeah, thank you. I work on the Wall Street Journal poll, and we had some interesting findings. Now, there are caveats and limitations that to these findings, but when we polled in November, we asked what we call the generic ballot question, which is, do you intend to vote, or if the election were today, would you vote for a Democrat for Congress or for a Republican for Congress? And it's called the generic ballot because people might feel differently if you were to supply actual names and put names of an incumbent in or people they know. But in our November poll, we found the two parties tied among Hispanic voters, 37-37, on which party Hispanic voters said they would vote for if the election were that day. In March, when we polled again, we found Hispanic voters favoring a generic Republican over Democrat by 9 percentage points. So there's a margin of error in these polls. There were maybe 160, 170 individuals, which is large enough to report, and we feel good about reporting it, but it's not large enough to dive under the hood very much with, and it has a margin of error. And we did not offer Spanish language interviews. So that's a consideration people should know when they look at these numbers, but it looked like a notable shift. What we can't tell from this polling, but which you practitioners might have a sense of, is kind of what's going on under the hood. And there's just so many theories about what's happening here. The Hispanic vote is important in its own right, but it's also important because, again, coming to Catalyst, 50% of Hispanic or Latino Americans who are eligible to vote are not voting, 50%, which is a higher share of that racial ethnic group than other racial ethnic groups. So there's this big body of people who are available to the political system who haven't come in. And I'm wondering whether you guys think, one theory is that younger people tend to skew Democratic. The Latino population in this country is young. As Latino voters age into the system, will they naturally vote Democratic, like many other young people do? There's a countervailing theory, which is that people who are not aging in, who have been alienated from the election system, who had the chance to vote in the past and bypassed it, but have been kind of brought in lately because politics is so attenuated and dramatic now, they're less partisan. They're lower information voters. They're less attached to either political party, and they're more available to Republicans. So I'm just kind of wondering what the Latino vote looks like going forward, whether it's mostly young people, whether it's people who could have voted but are only doing so now, and what kind of biases or predilections they bring with them as they come in to the election system.
Chuck, I want you to talk about some of the things you've talked about online and elsewhere, pushing back a little bit on this narrative. I mean, we have the data. We know that there is a movement, but you've been very vocal in saying, look, we're not there yet. And is this information able to be challenged in a meaningful way, right? What are your thoughts, Chuck?
Well, Aaron is right about a bunch of us don't vote, and half of us don't vote. Ecky's numbers don't lie. And you know how I feel about people who give us their thoughts who don't work in this business, not singling out Aaron, but looking at people who figure out why. So part of what Aaron said is absolutely right. It's not one thing, but it is that our average age is 27, right? So we act like that voter on average. Is that the singular reason? No, it's one of three or four. Quickly, that's one. Two would be because they don't have a voting history, no campaigns that me and Mike Madrid run are ever going to target those people, because not only are they infrequent voters, they are literally labeled non-voters. So you spend no resources in a current campaign environment to talk to those people. So they never get asked, Aaron, even to participate in the of organizing 101. Is the reason people don't participate is they never get asked. So A, they're younger. B, they never get asked. And then C, you have two parties who up until just recently would walk past the Latino neighborhood because, quote unquote, those people don't vote. And the ones who do are older, they're Mexican, they're more reliable Democrats. You go talk to them a little bit at the end of this thing and just kind of get them out without giving them a persuasion narrative like you would do a white woman in that same Eastern Pennsylvania suburb that you reported on. So my research after the last election, we talked to 1,500 people in Miami-Dade in the Texas Valley, and I dig deep into what happened there through my super PAC and through what we were doing at my firm, and just realized there was a one-sided conversation. COVID was happening. There was nobody knocking, but there's a pattern, right? And when we start talking about polling, everybody here listening should understand that there are just so many different flaws in the conception of polling itself. It just gives us, and Aaron was open about this, it just gives us a snapshot of where we are. We say it's a moment in time and yada, yada. But you factor that in with a community that's consuming information in two different languages. You average that in a community that's average age is 27, it's more transient, and it originates from origins all over Caribbean America, South America, Central America, and Mexico, all of the above. So it makes it almost impossible with an oversample of 100 or 200 in a nationwide poll, even in a state, to actually find out where, quote unquote, the Latino voting community is, because it's just hard to track them. I've been doing this work for 32 years. And the reason when we were getting information back on Bernie Sanders, when we had our historic run with the Bernie Sanders campaign, is I took polling as one piece of what was going on. We had hundreds of people on the ground. So I was getting real time data, Aaron, every day from our distributed organizing campaign in Spanish and English. I would add that to the polling data, work that with focus groups that were handling in multiple languages and testing that was happening online. And then I had a Mike Madrid plethora hurricane of information coming at me that would have made Mike get all giggly inside because it was just a bunch of numbers, right? So this is how I started looking at what was actually happening, because as you said, just one source of that is just not enough.
Mike, love your thoughts on this.
Yeah, this is a favorite part of the discussion for me, because, again, as somebody who's been doing races in California for 30 years and watching so many of these districts change, I'm actually sitting in downtown Los Angeles right now on the 15th floor of the Metro building right in downtown, looking over at East LA and thinking about the 30 years I've been doing campaigns and involved and engaged. One of the things that has been absolutely true about the dynamic of Latinos and Hispanics growing as part of the electorate is we have seen, to Aaron's point, a commensurate reduction in turnout to frightening levels, actually, in California, where you have very Hispanic dense communities with extraordinarily few voters. And there are both demographic reasons for that, and most importantly, there are also tactical reasons, as Chuck just pointed out. So let me try to explain both of those from my perspective. Both Aaron and Chuck just agreed this is a younger demographic. That is something the youth, young people don't vote regardless of what ethnicity or race you are. just generally, younger people vote less. We also have to acknowledge, and no one has said this yet, we are poorer by quite a considerable number. We are a poorer demographic. And it doesn't matter whether you're poor and Black in the Deep South, or you're poor and white in Appalachia, or poor and Latino in East Los Angeles. If you're poor, that is a data point that shows that you are less civically engaged, much less likely to vote, and much less likely to participate in the electoral process. So we have to recognize that too. There's also a correlation between being young and being poor. That's when people tend to be poor, is when they're younger. They build wealth over the years, and that dynamic starts to change, as Aaron was kind of pointing out, what is likely to happen. That takes me to the tactical part. And Chuck is saying something that is really, really important. When we are hired as consultants to campaign, our job is to get 50% plus one of the people who vote. And campaign dollars are so precious, we only spend time talking to those most likely to vote, because you don't get, campaign money is not unlimited. And what we call the efficiency of the spend, meaning is it more likely to get and or convince people who we know are going to vote, or spend money trying to turn non-voters into voters? Anybody who's doing this for a long time is going to tell you it's way better to talk to people who are going to vote and try to get them to move in your direction. So we spend very, very little, if any money, on people that aren't voting at least out of three of the last four elections. So what happens if you're not one of those three of four voters and another election comes around? Well, suddenly you're a two of five voter, and then you become a one of six voter, and then a one of eight voter. And then, as Chuck said, literally nobody is talking to you because there's no, we don't see the efficiency of investing in you as a voter. And again, as political consultants, our job is to win races. It's not to improve democracy. You can do both, and somebody should be more focused on that and engaging that. And there's a lot of civil rights and community-based organizations trying to accommodate that. But in the context of a campaign, I would be committing malpractice if I was spending money trying to turn out this newer vote when I'm trying to win the race. And so that's why it doesn't happen. And then it becomes a chicken and egg problem, or a problem that feeds upon itself, because you don't vote, I don't talk to you, I don't talk to you, you don't vote, And that keeps going on for many, many years. And it's hard to get that pattern to break. Now, one quick caveat. And again, this gets back to Aaron's point on what's likely to happen. As Hispanics do demonstrate economic mobility in some parts of the country, California is not a good example of this, by the way. We're beginning to see multi-generational poverty in a state that we never saw before. At the same time, Latinos are becoming the largest ethnic plurality. And that is extremely problematic, not just for a state, but for a democracy and for civic engagement and civic participation. So as long as economic mobility continues the way we are seeing primarily in other states, my guess is demographically, you can expect more and more civic engagement as people buy homes, as they have children that go to public schools, as they pay taxes for those public schools, as they start to view crime and safety issues a little bit more differently in their mid late 30s than they did in their mid 20s. So as that does happen, as wealth is accumulated, as people can become more conservative with a small c conservative, there's those capitals and small c's, Chuck, for you to write down so you can remember which one I'm using here. Small
useless. C, it's useless to me, but go ahead.
The small c conservatives, what it means is that people have more of a stake in their society and are more likely to vote. But I will say this, because of some of these demographics, poverty, which is becoming endemic, because of some of the pockets, the very large pocket states with very large numbers of Latinos, we do disproportionately not vote compared to whites, non-Hispanics, certainly even African-Americans. It's a problem that really does, could be problematic for civic engagement and democratic, small d democratic participation if we don't get onto this problem and nip it in the bud, because I'm worried about it. I've been worried about it for a long time. And a lot of that is just being a Californian and seeing some of these districts where you can literally get elected to a district that represents 500,000 people with maybe less than 30,000 voters.
So can I use your comments, Mike and Chuck, to ask you practitioners a question that's on my mind? Oversimplifying here, there are two propositions that I see about what happened and why Democrats underperformed in this last election. One is that this is temporary, it's reversible, it results from tactical errors. Democrats didn't ask in Texas. The Texas Democratic Party did a postmortem and said one of our main problems was we shut down person-to-person contact. You hear a lot of Democrats saying our mistake here was tactical. We treated the Hispanic vote as a turnout opportunity, not a persuasion problem to solve. And this was related to our strategic mistake in not asking enough, not seeing Hispanic voters as persuasion targets. And it's passing because it's related to COVID, economic shutdown, and the unique factors of the Trump era. That's one proposition. The other is, no, this is a long-term, durable problem. The Democrats are in deep trouble. The image of the party is tarnished. They are now perceived as the party that is not supportive of law enforcement. And many Hispanic families have border security agents and law enforcement in their families and are crime victims and live in places where there has been a crime. The Democratic Party is too focused on racial grievance and what some call the woke agenda. And you can throw all kinds of issues, some perhaps more real than others, some more emotionally driven and some in the real world around critical race theory and whether equity should be the goal instead of equality, that is alienating to Hispanic voters. And that the Republican Party trying to become the party of the pan-racial working class is having some success in drawing some of the voters that Mike was talking about, lower income folks, where they couldn't before, that they've kind of picked a lock and learned how to talk to lower income voters, and the Democrats have frittered away what was a positive party image by adopting the wrong issues. Do you guys have a sense of whether this shift is driven, that we saw is driven by temporary factors, or is something more problematic for the Democratic Party, durable and speaking to their broader image?
Look, I think it's both. I think that there was an anomaly that happened in the last election called Donald Trump. the numbers will bear out how big of an impact will he have on this election, not being on the ticket. It just goes from all the research that I've done, talking to Latinos on the ground in areas where he overperformed by 20 points. He had a factor. He was a factor. Will he be as big a factor? Chuck Rocha, the operative, would say not as much, but that could bear out to prove me wrong. But historical data would tell me in elections that I work in that it just will not, it was an anomaly with an asterisk. You got to recognize, though, over the, since we talk about this a lot on this podcast, you know, since George Bush, that Republicans have done a better job. Mike Madrid would say it's still whistling past the grave and all the things that they're not doing a great job, but they are doing something that they had never done, at least trying to compete for that vote. And Aaron, I will tell you, starting in 1989, when I worked for Ann Richards in Texas, you know, it's different today. There are Republicans right now up in Spanish talking to Latinos. And so that's a problem. And now there's been a competitiveness that's exposed the underbelly of the weak outreach that Democrats had been doing. You layer on the COVID phenomenon back to your spike. That used to be all Democrats would do. We put a bunch of Latino organizers on the ground the last 4 weeks and tried to get that vote out. Well, we couldn't do that because of the pandemic, plus Donald Trump, plus what I just described to you. And the last point I'll make, and I know I'm not giving you a black or white answer, but I'm just trying to be very honest. The last and the most disturbing thing, and Mike talked about this in his New York Times op-ed, is this thing about working class values. I just told you I started my career as a steel worker, right? And I was a rubber worker, local union officer in Tyler, Texas. I ain't never been to college. I'm that non-college educated brown man who is a little redneck, but has been very woken in his last century of life here, right? And so ran Bernie Sanders' campaign. But I hunger for the days of the Democratic Party that I joined that said that the Democrats are with the workers and the Republicans are with the bosses. And when we get back to that Dick Gephardt style campaigning, when he talked about sewage running down the streets in Mexico, and this is where our jobs are going. I was on the floor for that in the gallery as a rubber worker, right? Like, this is the reason Bernie Sanders won all of those counties in the valley that Donald Trump overperformed in. I tell people all the time, we talk about it verbatim here, that our message was a popular economic issue, talking about a rigged system to these Latinos who feel forgotten about in this place in our country. So I think all of those things are my personal response to the question, Mike.
That, yeah, look, this is, I love this conversation, and that's exactly the right question, Aaron, that you're asking. And so I see things a little bit differently than Chuck does, but I'm going to answer the same way. It is both. It is both a short-term bump and a long-term trend, and there's some anomalies in there. And again, I see them differently, so let me explain them. The first is, and again, as somebody who's been looking at this and looking at data and looking at voters for 30 years, Latino voters for 30 years, you know, I was saying, you know, as an undergrad at Georgetown 30 years ago, there's going to be a long-term movement towards the Republican Party. That was stalled dramatically, again, in the Southwest, specifically in California and in Arizona, because of the unique polarizing conversations we were having for 20 years in those states specifically. That's kind of still my working hypothesis. But the bigger issue is what is happening is there is a consolidation among in the Democratic Party of college-educated white voters. In the Republican Party, there is a dramatic consolidation of non-college-educated white voters. What we're seeing, and you're starting to see it, Axios Ipsos did a poll today, released a poll today, just today, with African American support levels for Biden starting to show even more measurable reductions, and Latinos. Latinos are the non-college educated workforce of the future. And so the fact that they're behaving like that in the voting booth and with public opinion should tell us that this, again, is part of a long-term trend. Was there an anomaly during the Trump years? Yes, but that was not 2020, it was 2016. And that's what people are really getting wrong, and let me explain why. Donald Trump began his presidential campaign in 2016, coming down the escalator and going directly after Mexicans and calling them rapists and drug dealers and perhaps some very fine people. He then, within a matter of weeks, attacks Judge Curiel, who says he can't be a judge because he's Mexican, so he doesn't know anything about being a jurist and he can't be objective. He then starts going to a litany of build the wall chants, which was really the marquee chant, along with lock her up, at all of his these aggressive, angry grievance rallies. None of that was evident in the 2020 cycle. None of it. Why? Because they looked at the map and realized, hey, we can win this vote if we drop that rhetoric. And you know what? They were right. The anomaly then tells me it's 16, not 20. And if you look at the direction of a lot of these Sunbelt states, even places like Texas, where Democrats made a really big error in saying Texas is going to go blue because of the Hispanic vote. For 10 years, I've been saying, no, it's not. No, it's not. If it's going to go blue, it's going to go blue because of white college-educated workers. And the challenge that the Democratic Party has is as it becomes a whiter party, a higher educated party with people who are culturally focused on what that demographic focuses on, they are alienating the working class. And the working class is increasingly every day Hispanic. This is what I write about in the New York Times op-ed. It's a really good question, but I do not believe it's all. I also don't believe for a second this is a swing vote. You know, a lot of prognosticators are starting to say, oh, it's moving right. It's got to be a swing vote. There's no evidence to suggest that. There is no evidence to suggest that. There has been plenty of evidence to suggest it's a slow moving vote towards the right that is picking up steam, but we have not seen a swing back, at least not to this point. So it could be either. But if you buy that there's the demographic underpinnings that I'm talking about are showing a migration to the right, the way other immigrant groups in this country's past have, I would suggest we are on the precipice of a very long-term generational trend of Latinos potentially moderating both parties, which I think is good for democracy, but certainly moving away from the Democratic Party. And this is what I'm going to end this diatribe on. I don't believe that the Republicans have found any secret sauce, not for one second. They may be showing up, but they were showing up when I was doing these races for the RNC in 2000. We certainly were getting that vote response for George W. Bush. Okay, I was doing a ton of this work in 2000 and 2002 and in 1998, and we would show up and we would get 1, 2, 3 points. Okay, so there is some value to that. But when I really figured out there's something very significant happening here, and I don't know if Chuck, if you were in this race or not, I think you probably were. But the day things clicked for me, and I've been waiting for this moment for 25 years, was the Nevada caucuses in 2016, when Bernie comes out of nowhere and is organizing service employee workers, 95% Hispanic, in Clark County, and shocks the world by basically, you know, essentially winning I still think he won the caucuses, Chuck. I don't know if you're engaged in the 16 race or not, but they were doing a tremendous amount of organizing with his constituency. And they did something that no other campaign, Republican or Democrat, had ever done, which was dramatically overperform the turnout model. Now, you can only do that with really damn good organizing. You can only do that tactically. But I also believe, to Chuck's point, there's also a populist message there. Bernie Sanders was not just running against the Republicans. He was saying the whole damn system's corrupt. The cards are stacked against you. And that message resonates with these workers who believe that, because there's a lot of truth to it. And they responded to both message and tactics. And that's why I believe we have very low voter turnout, is because the Democrats are not selling a message that resonates. Because, and I'll promise I'm going to wrap it up right here, the Democratic Party is no longer a party of the working class. They think they are, but they are no longer, and this is not Mike Madrid saying this, this is working class voters saying this. If you look at where working class voters live, of every ethnicity, they are getting more Republican. Those that are in the new economy workers, they are becoming more Democrat. And that is not sustainable for Democrats if you keep alienating working class voters when 65% of voters in this country do not have a college degree.
This is so great. You know, I've been taking notes as you guys write, as you guys talk. I've been taking notes. I have a page full here, and I'm sure listeners at home are too. And I just hope whoever is driving while they're listening to this podcast pulls over before they take notes in there.
Aaron, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate you. And this is, I end this program every week by talking about how fascinating the discussion is, just for me to be able to listen to smart people like you go after it. It's just really enlightening for me. So thank you for your time. We look forward to reading your next piece as it comes out, and we'll be watching what's going on out there. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in this week to the Latino Podcast Vote, the Latino Vote Podcast. And I look forward to hearing from you, listeners. And also next time, we've got another guest from NBC News, Suzanne Gamboa, will be on. And we look forward to welcoming her as well. Thank you, everybody. And we'll talk to you next time.